Great. So we're looking at number 10 in the on coping chapter, right? So Daniel's saying it's useful, and I was just encouraging you to maybe even not in the chat or out loud per se, but just for yourself especially, right? How was it useful? What about it stood out to you as being something that you could implement? And thank you for the reflection on that and for the suggestion too with the recording situation. Naya. Sure, yeah, I think it's a good point, right? Number 10 definitely talks about how powerful it is and how controlling it can be. And let's even go to 10 real quick. I'll share my screen and let's get to that specific reference, right? Right at the beginning. And that's an important point he raises, right? Anxiety can, I think, at times definitely. Am I already sharing my screen? Okay, I'm sharing the wrong screen. Give me a second. But Tanaya's second point, yeah, that's a part of what he's saying here, right? Ultimately, what he's suggesting is that the anxiety, to an extent, I'm not sure if I would use the word distraction necessarily, but I think it's a good word to use right now, or it's, you know, fits well enough with his description. It's calling attention away from the actual issue, right? So the literal thing we're anxious about isn't the sort of the larger picture, and at the very least, it's not the most important thing we could be thinking about. So what he's saying in number 10, in my opinion, is sort of he's encouraging us to practice, in a way, redirecting our thinking and feeling, right? So as we talked about a little bit last class, I hope we came up, or you know, we encounter some strategies that might be useful for confronting anxiety and worry, right? So we talked about those questions: is it real? Is it true? Is it helpful? We talked about the power of acceptance, and then through acceptance, learning how to laugh and our anxieties, right? We talked about going back and taking time to meditate on past events that might be influencing our ways of seeing and feeling and being in the moment, right? All of which, of course, connect to also improving the way we view the future. We define anxiety, right, as a future-driven negative set of thoughts and feelings, right? So it's essentially perceiving the future as something negative. And then in addition to that, perceiving ourselves, I think more often than not, in addition to that, perceiving ourselves as not being able to move through those challenges and thrive and flourish, right? So that being said, number 10, I think, is giving us another sort of tool in that toolbox, right? I think we in this class did encounter the idea of mental equipment. Mental equipment being, again, the set of, let's say, practices, principles we can implement in our lives to lead, in this case, less anxious lives, and let's even say more confident lives, right? Because I think anxiety and confidence do kind of, confidence is one potential antidote to anxiety, among others, right? On that note, let's talk about 10 more specifically, right? So to Naya's point, he's saying in that first paragraph, anxiety dominates over and excludes any other form of mental activity. All that will be in our minds is terror. Okay, I think the reason for this might be that anxiety is really, you know, it resides in our imaginations. So if we're not tethering our thoughts to something real in the moment, our imagination just keeps growing, right? Our imaginations are not real. There's a quote, I think it's from Seneca, that the false is limitless, right? So you could just keep going, right? You in your imagination with anxiety, you literally could just keep making things worse. There's no need to stop that. Right? Maybe it's just, obviously the need might be that you get super tired and fall asleep, right? But ultimately, we could always just keep diving deeper down into, let's say, or spiral into greater senses and feelings and thoughts of anxiety, because again, it's not real, right? And then the false, it's a great quote for this actually, the false is limitless. So you want to keep that in mind. I think that's why, among other reasons, maybe he's saying it has the, let's say, the capacity to be all-consuming, right? So he's saying there is one nimble way to try to outwit anxiety. And I think we have more than one already, but just for argument's sake, let's see what he's saying here. And that is with a question that recognizes a fundamental feature of anxiety, that it is frequently a smokescreen, and again, distraction is a good word for that too, for something else, something beyond what we consciously think is worrying us, that we're in fact concerned with or about. Right? So there's a larger issue behind, let's say, the small anxiety, right? So the thing, and we talked about another strategy yesterday of being able to discern or tell what provokes anxiety versus what actually deserves it. And that's another interesting point that I think works with this kind of nicely, right? Because the thing that might provoke it is the smaller, let's say, manifestation of the larger fear that actually might deserve anxiety, right? Or not. We have to see. That's a part of this whole process, right? One of the peculiar facets of our minds is that we may choose to feel anxious rather than to confront things that may be yet more painful or emotionally awkward in our lives. It can be easier to fret than to know ourselves properly. So to know ourselves properly, again, I love this idea of like maps of the self, like topographies of the self. What are you actually afraid of is sort of the question here. Okay, panic or the seeming sense of panic may be invited to shield us from more profound sources of self-aware agony. Okay, so when we stop focusing on what's making us, what's causing us to panic, okay, we have to move through that. As he's saying here, if your mind, we ask this to ourselves, if your mind wasn't currently filled with these particular anxious thoughts, what might you have to think about right now? Okay, and so behind the thing, behind the anxiety of will my friends hang out with me this weekend, behind the anxiety of will that person respond to my ask them to go out to dinner, right? Will the party be uncomfortable and boring? Will the interview at work go well, go poorly? We might realize how lonely we are. We might realize how angry we are towards our partner. We might realize how abandoned we feel, right? So abandonment, anger, sadness, these are the real things we want to confront. Right, the party is ultimately just a manifestation of maybe a fear that we aren't cool enough, or that we aren't entertaining enough, or engaging enough, or charismatic enough. Right, and that's the real thing we want to address, that perception of the self. Right, and I think through this we can get a lot of growth. One, because we might be able to start conquering our anxieties, and that's growing in tranquility. And also, some of these anxieties may even, let's say, be sort of they may call to our attention ways we can improve, like aside from becoming more tranquil, right? So maybe behind the real fear is some information that can help us form ourselves. And again, we're doing that either way, because sometimes information will just be ridiculous, like, and we can dismiss it. Oh, that's not true. That's not real. That's not helpful. Okay. I am charismatic enough. I'm not going to keep telling myself I'm not. I don't need to strive necessarily with a great amount of effort to, to work on X, Y, or Z. And then other times I think it will be kind of a guide towards development of those traits. Or maybe I can be a better listener, right? Maybe I can work on, let's say, my interview skills, right? So maybe the anxiety that leads us to the larger fear, let's say, actually has something to tell us that leads to a whole different set of actions. Right, that could be positive. And other times too, I think, as we said, we have to learn how to sometimes dismiss these ideas, right? But again, those three questions I think work with this really nicely, right? Is it true that I'm lonely? Is it real that I'm lonely, right? Which is to say, well, am I maybe alone a lot? Am I alone more than I would like to be? Well, is it helpful to know that I'm lonely? Yeah, it's helpful because, okay, maybe let me pick up a hobby. Let me try to reach out to friends more, right? And then we're really moving at that point, right? So some of these things, these larger problems, again, we need to address those instead of just addressing the small manifestations and allowing ourselves to become anxious over them. So it's really not this weekend that's bothering you, it's the past 6 months, right? So how can we maybe take greater control over these actual problems? How can we think, feel, and act in a different way so the next 6 months we do feel less lonely? And even stick with that example, right? When you're generally, and this is, I think, this goes for introverts and extroverts. When you generally feel like you're full in regards to, let's say, like social interactions, one weekend that goes poorly won't feel as bad to you, right? Again, if you're generally, let's say, joyful person, one sad event, again, of course, it varies based on the degree to which the event is sad, right? But let's say one small sad event doesn't ruin your whole month, right? Or even in the case of anxiety, right? It'll seem less scary to you. The possibility of sadness, if you are joyful in the moment and you're generally joyful, will seem like something you can weather more easily, right? Something you can deal with more easily. So by addressing our larger fears, okay, we actually start getting better information. Because again, the small triggers that he gives some examples in this essay, right, kind of just fill our mind with fear. They don't really do much for us. But when we get to the real issue behind it, right, and we start to get to know ourselves, why are we angry? Why are we sad? And we start to really start making progress on this whole anxiety thing. And Naya, to your second point, right? That's what he's saying. Yeah, I think there's a great interpretation you have, right? We don't want to deal with that big stuff. And I like how you put easier in quotes, right? It's easier to get flustered, as he's saying here, and ignore what the actual issue is, because the actual issue would require, as I just kind of walked us through it, and I think an optimistic sense, it might require that we make some changes. Change is scary. Okay. We should work to make change less scary, but ultimately, I think change is something that we're naturally afraid of, even a good change. Right, especially if we're individuals who may deal with some anxiety, right? Change is especially scary because even if you get the thing you want, you become anxious, what? That you're going to lose it, right? So again, we'll talk about that. I think that meaning change throughout the summer, because that just sort of is a it's something I'm even asking you to do, right? Today, as I mentioned last class, we're going to pause for happiness on a little for a little bit, and we're going to make sure we cover practices. At least start it today, because again, one of your final take-home options is to adopt a practice for a week. I want to make sure we have time to think about that. But I'm asking that you make changes, right? Or I'm not asking you, I'm encouraging you maybe to consider what would spending 10 minutes a day in a new way feel like? What could that do for me, right? And the more I work with students, the more I work with my clients for my philosophical consultation stuff, the more I'm seeing like the self-writing is powerful. So I'm gonna really be very encouraging on that because the self-writing has helped a lot of people deal with anxiety among other things. So I hope we enjoy that part of the class and the conversation today. Because what we're getting here too ultimately can happen in self-writing, right? For you to really do the work, again, it's not easy, but to do the work to focus on like what am I actually afraid of, I would suggest writing that out because it's gonna be clearer, it's gonna be more accurate, it's gonna be more detailed. It could be something that you're disciplined about, right? More so than I would say, disciplining your thoughts is more difficult than disciplining your writing. Once you get over the initial, let's say, once you get over the initial difficulty of integrating it as a habit, it really, I think, starts working pretty nicely, relatively soon, I would say. So, I mean, these are all exercises. I might realize these are things you have to work on. So, as Naya is saying, right, it's harder to confront the real issue. But he's saying here that that's the pathway to a less anxious life. Okay. And I like how he makes the following distinction because it's a distinction I made a moment ago too with whether or not we should engage with these fears and these anxieties to then make changes, to do new things, right? Or can we dismiss them? So he says here, right? Certain anxieties can be taken at face value, for they do clearly relate to worrying things in the world, right? So those are the normal, let's say, normal anxieties. And we've said anxiety is normal, right? But there is another class of them, and a rather large one at that, that is there for no better purpose than to distract us from understanding important parts of ourselves. If we need to suffer, and often we will, the least we could do is to ensure that we are suffering for the right reasons. So there's a lot of, I don't want to say complexity here, but there's levels to this conversation, right? So he's illuminating another one here. Some small anxieties are useful if we address them because they guide us to these larger anxieties. Right, so we shouldn't ignore our anxieties is ultimately what he's saying here. I think rather clearly, right? He's asking us to address them in a very meaningful way. Right? And we address them with the following question, and he kind of is repetitive here, but I think it's a good point to end on. You ask yourself, if my mind wasn't currently filled with these particular anxious thoughts, what might I have to think about right now? So I think there's a couple ways to interpret that too, right? So one might be, oh, the larger issue is what I could think about. I could think about addressing loneliness, sadness, and anger, resentment, or what have you in my life that is, let's say, a habit. It's a habitual way of being and feeling. That's the real issue here. I also think at times, especially when, let's say, the small anxiety is not something we can. And here's a question for me right now, and I wonder how he would respond to this. Do we think that every anxiety is attached to a larger way of being? Right? Or a larger, let's say, problem in our lives, an ongoing problem? I wonder that. I think maybe if the answer is yes, then this essay is incredibly, incredibly useful. And I think it's very useful even if the answer is no. Right? And maybe I'm making a misinterpretation here, right? If we come to know ourselves well enough, I think we may find that there are certain patterns of anxieties, right? And that's through our engagement with ourselves and our engagement with the world. right? So let's say, for example, and this is an example he gives a lot in his works, right? You're more of an introvert. So parties have a tendency to exhaust you and make you anxious, right? So parties come up in life. It's a part of life, gatherings, right? They're going to happen. So if you know that that is something that will trigger some anxiety for you, and maybe you're able to say, you know what, I'm anxious about this because I fear, let's say that I'm being judged by others, and I now know that that's not rational. Like, nobody really cares, right? And let's say I had childhood experiences, whether it was with family parties or even, like, let's say teenage experiences at parties that were not positive, and I haven't really left those behind adequately. Right, because he's saying here too that some anxieties we can take at face value because they relate to worrying things in the world. Right. Well, let's say, for example, the worrying thing in the world to me is a gathering, right, or a party, let's say. How quickly does knowing ourselves help us dismiss that as, okay, you know what? It's not the thing itself that is a problem. It's my perception. I know my perception is flawed. So you know what? I'm just going to laugh at this. Back to his other essay. Right. So I think maybe what I'm arguing here, and I'm kind of, it might be a little bit obvious, but I'm grappling with this right now in real time. What I might be thinking of is, to what extent is this essay yet again another pathway to learning to just accept and laugh, right? Maybe I'm a little bit, to shift the example, maybe I'm a little bit of an angry person. All right, well, you know what? I'm not going to get angry because I'm realizing that I'm triggered to become angry and anxious. And then anxious about being angry. Like, I wonder if I'm going to get angry at this party or whatever, right? Or I wonder if I'm going to get angry when I have to wait in line, rather than I'm going to feel anxious about getting angry, right? But to what extent does the unpacking our personal history, as we talked about yesterday, and then kind of maybe from more of a philosophical standpoint, unpacking the larger parts of ourselves or the larger parts of our history, or the larger parts of our relationship, how much does that, once again, lead back to acceptance and laughter? Right, especially this last paragraph, he's asking us to learn how to take some at face value and then question others, right, such that they lead us into different directions. Okay, that direction being greater self-understanding, and that greater self-understanding potentially leads to acceptance and laughter and changes of thinking, feeling, and acting. So yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's interesting to consider how all these things connect. And I think this essay, again, provides another interesting pathway to not allow, let's say, what would trigger our anxieties to trigger them as intensely or as frequently. Because once we address, and again, I doubt this would be a one-time thing, right? This would be an ongoing discussion with ourselves about how we could maybe, instead of, again, necessarily just be less triggered to be angry, well, the question might be, why am I such an angry person? How could I be less angry generally is different than I'm anxious about getting angry tomorrow. Again, that's an anxiety-driven narrative versus an inquisitive sort of, let's say, productive narrative of how to address the larger issue at hand. Any other thoughts on this? Again, I think this really puts into question the way we kind of, like, let's say, size things or distance things. Or I mean, by the last term, like the way we create distance between ourselves and the things that make us anxious. Right? Again, the whole premise of this too, obviously, is know yourself. It's not that this event is making me angry. It's maybe that I'm just kind of, I'm holding a lot of anger in me right now. And on that note, I want to make a connection to number one. So let's scroll up for a minute here. So number one, we're reading from Epictetus, the Enchiridion, which is the manual, right? A part of his work. Again, he wrote nothing down. All of his students kept notes. And that's what we have from him. A large part of his work, as I think I described to him already, was dealing with things like anxiety and stress. And as a Stoic, those are really important. They want to use logic to create a stress, or let's say, create as stress-free a life as possible. And as a teacher, I'd often imagine him like fielding questions from his students, and then they would write down responses. And a lot of his school was based on the idea that it was a hospital. I may have discussed this already. I apologize if I'm repeating myself. as a hospital for people, basically with problems of the soul, right, with philosophical problems. So this is, you know, in a lot of ways, I think, laying some groundwork, at least, and I say some for a reason, right, for like modern psychotherapy, right? I think we feel that with Epictetus specifically. And number two is exactly what I'm saying here. Men are disturbed not by things, but by the principles or ideas and notions which they form concerning things. So if you have a proclivity for being angry, that will affect the ideas you form concerning things. You will be more, we could argue with this, but I think it's interesting. You will be more easily angered than someone who isn't, let's say, carrying anger with them. I think we can see this with ourselves and others pretty clearly. Right? Now, are there some things that are, let's say, naturally disturbing? I would say yes. And I would say that's a good, again, it's not a good thing that they are disturbing or that there are disturbing things, right? But I think that we need to be disturbed by things, is what I'm trying to say. Some things should disturb us, right? And the Stoics, and I would include Epictetus in this, were very concerned with serving humanity, right? Which would imply to me that they would acknowledge that there is such a thing as doing something wrong, right? There is such a thing as improving ourselves, which is to say that, as you know, the idea of a hospital, right? We are hurt as people, right? And so that's a natural part of being a person. I like to have somewhat of a sympathetic, in some context, interpretation of the Stoics. I think in a lot of our modern understanding of them, people may say they're encouraging us to not have feelings. I don't think that's fair. Entirely. Again, I'm maybe a little sympathetic to them here. I think they're saying we feel robustly, and sometimes that damages us. So we should learn how to feel in a way that is more rational, right? In a way that is more helpful to ourselves and others, and try to avoid feelings and thoughts that are destructive, right? Which is the whole point of the chapter being called On Coping, right? Coping to me implies, okay, there's something, just for argument's sake, there's something wrong here. I have to deal with this now. I don't want to be anxious. I don't want to be stressed. I don't want to be afraid in excess, right? So to cope, to me, implies, okay, we're getting better, right? And this chapter focuses a lot on anxiety because I just think that's a very relevant point culturally, right? The more I'm researching philosophy as a form of therapy, I'm sort of learning about, well, okay, what are the most useful things that mentality, that philosophy about philosophy can do? Well, okay, well, it has to serve us to solve the issues that we're dealing with most frequently and most intensely. Anxiety is huge right now. So I think that's, again, why we have so many discussions about it. But again, Epictetus is telling us something very similar to what number 10 is telling us, right? The notions we form around things are likely going to be influenced by not by the things themselves, as he's saying here, but by these larger modes of being within ourselves that we have to come to know. Okay, so when therefore we are hindered or disturbed or grieved, let us never attribute it to others, but to ourselves, that is to our own principles or ideas. So again, we could argue with this is very interesting stuff, but would this not give us more power, right? If you know you are easily, you're easily drawn to impatience, right? And you stop blaming the external world for that. And instead, let's even take the word blame out for a moment, but instead saw yourself as the source of your impatience, maybe because of the way you view time, maybe because of the way you view yourself as always being behind, right? Would you benefit from that? Again, this is a question we could argue about, I think, quite interestingly. If this is excessive, it's a problem. I think even for the Stoics, if this is excessive, it's a problem, because they do want us to acknowledge that the external world exists, right? And that we are, in fact, influenced by it. We're going to go to number seven in a moment. I'm going to do a little lecture on a part of Nicomachean Ethics where Aristotle is advising his son. He's like, look, chance happens. The universe is real. Fortune, misfortune is real. You will be affected by it, right? But it's up to you then, and Aristotle takes it, I think, in a similar direction. Like, you can still shine through that. You can, again, cope with that with nobility. So we're getting sort of, I think, different angles here on how to basically deal with stuff. So right, if the things, and again, back to number, we're going to be moving between 10, 7, and 1 a little bit here, right? If you really sat down and wrote about the larger issues at hand, and then saw how those might be shaping the way you see things, that's going to help you cope, right? Because again, he's asking us to consider here number two, it's not the thing you're seeing, it's the way you're seeing it. And ultimately, there's a great Arabic proverb. I'm not sure if I shared this yesterday. I think I did, but it really applies here as well, right? If you cannot move the rock, kiss it. I think that's very interesting, right? The Stoics would really agree with that. Again, that Marcus Aurelius quote, the obstacle is the way. So if you start viewing the obstacle as the way, the path itself, is it an obstacle anymore? Again, this is going to be very, let's say, specific to the particular circumstance you're in, of course. So there may be examples that exist outside of this philosophy. I would argue that there are, right? But especially in terms of, let's say, the daily life examples that we may be able to think of, like, this is potentially very helpful. Anyone else? Let's talk about number one. I'd love to hear people from people's opinions on number one, and we could even just put a number. We have six, I think, pretty interesting entries here from Epictetus. What do we think? Somebody, give me a number and maybe elaborate on it a little bit. Or I've only talked about number two, so if there's any thoughts on that, or again, if there's a number you want me to elaborate on, how do these ideas help us cope? If they do, maybe you disagree, right? Please take a minute here. I'd love to hear from people. Hamed, so I agree. One is interesting, and I would love to elaborate on one. What do you mean by it's the hardest for you? Like, as in the hardest to deal with, or like, do you want me to elaborate on it in terms of interpreting it for what I think it might mean, or like elaborate more upon why it's difficult in application? Because one is tough. I'll do my best to defend one from Epictetus' perspective, as I understand it. Then I also will question it myself too, I think. I agree with what you're saying, Hamed, but can you point to a page number for that? So let me, Hamed, I'll give you a minute there. Let me look at 109, number one. Right? So this is one of the, I think, objectively, or let's say, not objectively, seemingly cold pieces of advice from Epictetus, right? So with regard to whatever objects you delight, are useful, or are deeply loved, remember to tell yourself of what general nature they are. Why? So this is awareness. The Stoics want us to be aware. And they understand, and I think this is a really significant point, right, that to love usually involves suffering, right? So again, their purpose in life is to help us deal with suffering and to rid ourselves of suffering the best we can, right? And then he gives you an example. If, for example, you are fond of a specific ceramic cup, remind yourself that it is only ceramic cups in general of which you are fond. Then if it breaks, you will not be disturbed. If you kiss your child or your wife, say that you only kiss things which are human, and thus you will not be disturbed, right, if either of them dies. So this is cold, right? This is extreme. Let's work with it a little bit, right? Now, one, this is maybe incorrect, and maybe I'm doing my best to stand for Epictetus, and I'm already challenging it by saying it's cold, because it is, right? Let's remove the word disturbed. Keeping in mind this is a translation. And I think for our purposes too, let's make it paralyzed. Right? Let's make it paralyzed. Let's make it unable to move on and flourish. Let's make it unable to move on and be happy. Right? So One, the Stoics need us to never drift too far away from the fact that we're all mortal. So in a sense, that's almost what he's saying here. And I think a more sort of, let's say, overt and once again, cold way. And he's giving us examples that are the worst things we could think of, right? The reason for that, again, for the Stoics, they ask us to practice this premeditation of evils. Epictetus himself, right, says, every day remind yourself of your mortality. We have other advice, you know, or other Stoics too, living lives where, like, for let's say a period of time, they fast. And again, fasting, I think, is a good suggestion generally, perhaps, for us to consider. A lot of religious practices involve fasting, right? But Stoics would fast. They would sleep on the floor instead of in a bed. They would, you know, kind of do these exercises that they'd subject themselves to, like, extreme circumstances, right? Physically, mentally, spiritually, to basically toughen themselves up in a way, right? I put that, it's kind of an overly simplistic understanding of it. But essentially for some Stoics, and other Stoics looked at them, they're like, okay, that's not the point of this, right? The point of this is to lead a good life. You not eating and, you know, wearing clothes that you'll be cold when you go outside, that's not really philosophy, right? But to an extent, there is a little bit of a Venn diagram there, right? Where maybe that's an extreme sense of preparing oneself. But for Epictetus, to remind ourselves that we're mortal isn't all that extreme. And of course, we can disagree with that, right? But ultimately, what this is saying is, it's more than don't lie to yourself. It's prepare yourself. And prepare yourself for what? Ultimately, for the Stoics, this is my interpretation, it would be prepare yourself to be useful, to be of service, right? Because the sort of picture that Epictetus paints in his other works is, if an individual in your family is sick, for example, you want to be able to be as helpful to them as possible. You want to be able to be as helpful to your family as a community as possible. You do not want to succumb to grief. You do not want to succumb to sadness such that you're paralyzed, such that you can't hear the doctor and then be helpful, such that you have to leave the bedside of your loved one and not be there for them, right? So that's the aim here. The aim is to make ourselves resilient through these reminders, right? And I think too, you know, he's not saying when you kiss your child, for the entire time you're with them, after you kiss them, to think about this, right? So we're keeping in mind, it's the sort of frequent reminder, even memento mori, right? I would argue that that's a practice, and it's a practice I implement, I think about. Maybe it helps us in moments of anxiety to kind of, again, give us a step back and go, okay, this is small, right? To give us a step back and remind us that we should be doing things that challenge us with our lives as we still have our lives, right? Or as we're still alive, of course. So I think ultimately what this is saying too is it should increase the degree to which we appreciate the people in our lives. Again, I gave the example yesterday of the thing you would wrap if it was fragile, if you're going overseas or you're traveling and you're going to bring somebody a gift, right? If we treated life and if we treated our loved ones and our relationships as if they were ceramic cups, we would care for them more. So again, these sort of weird, I don't want to say contradictions, that's not the exact word I'm thinking of, but these ideas, I think, ultimately don't match, right? At least they seem like they don't match, but really they do. The acknowledgement of our, you know, the potential, let's say, well, the real circumstance that we're all mortal, and then the potentially terrible idea that we lose people we love, right? Before it might be even the expectation that we do, right? Should only encourage us to love them more. Should only encourage us to not take our time for granted with them. Or, you know what I mean? What do we think of this? I'm trying my best to see how this might be helpful and useful in regards to coping and the art of thriving. Right? Because even think about if somebody were to pass away before, again, the idea of it being expected is not even a good idea, right? Because it never feels that way. But ultimately, if you really took advantage of your time with this person and you loved them and you put your all into the relationship, you would feel better, right? There would be less regret. So this is also maybe a pathway to coping because it helps us lead a life where we're loving those around us as if they are going to pass away. right? To love people, we could even argue that maybe to fully love others, we need to remember that we're mortal and that they are mortal. And I mean fully love, right? To fully be engaged, maybe we need this type of encouragement, right? Can you really love people fully without remembering that both of you are mortal? Do we need that? Yeah, be more present. Exactly. Yeah. So maybe that's a part of this too, right? And I think that's a legitimate point. The ceramic cup kind of should provoke the sense that it's fragile. Then again, that fragility should encourage us to take care of it. Right? That question of what if can be a powerful one to get us to act in the moment in a way that is to the highest good. Right? To love people like we're all dying is to really love them. Right? So maybe we can work with the cold sort of, let's say, language or the cold image he's presenting here and see that it's the opposite of cold. Maybe this is the warmest way to be with people, the most passionate way to be with people. And if we guide that towards truth, goodness, justice, right, that those are, you know, this could be the driving force right here. Again, death as a driving force to live in the moment, the notion of death as a driving force to love people as well and as fully and as, you know, as committed as we can. All of those things to me are really healthy tools for coping. Less regret. And on top of that, you have the reminder. So you're less shocked if, God forbid, something does happen. Right? And of course, you know, that's, I think that we get a kind of a double benefit there. The reminder is useful as preparation, and the reminder is useful as encouragement to live a certain kind of life. Right? The one thing that's worse than getting punched in the face is getting punched in the face by surprise. Right? You're not prepared at all. So the Stoics are asking us to prepare ourselves. And they're also, I think, the same principles that are asking us to prepare in a lot of ways are encouraging us to imbue our lives with a greater sense of meaning and urgency. And those things are really useful too. Any other number? We had a couple other points in the chat. Let me see here. Naya, 4 and 6. What is pain? A mask. Turn it and examine it. That's exactly what number 10 is saying. Right? That's exactly what 10 is saying from today. And that's exactly what the bear analogy yesterday is saying. Localizing the bear means describing it. That means examining it. Right? You take the mask off, you look at it. That's a great philosophical piece of encouragement for why we should practice what 10 is suggesting and what the other readings from yesterday are suggesting as well. Number 6. If you do not wish to be prone to anger, do not feed the habit. Give it nothing which may tend to its increase, right? So we all do this. And sometimes, again, I think we have to do this. But you get, it's even say, he's saying anger, and I think there's evidence for that too. But just for me, I'm immediately drawn to the idea of you get sad, and then what do? You put on sad music. Then it's like sad music and ice cream. Then it's like a sad movie. Then it's like, let me speak some sadness, right? So we perpetuate these emotions. And the Stoics too are saying, look, don't cause your own suffering. Don't make yourself angry, right? There's a big difference between being angered and being an angry person. Well, the angry person is someone who just fuels that anger. The world's going to anger us. That's going to happen, right? But the angry person is like, let's put on metal, or let's put on angry music, right? And, or even like we talked about, I think, the idea of the motivations we choose. And this is maybe a little bit less about coping, but in regards to fueling, right, or doing things that tend to its increase. If you are angered by the world, sometimes rightfully so, then sometimes you're angered by the world because you're just in a bad mood, right? And maybe, you know, there's something on your mind that you're not examining or, you know, what have you. Okay, that'll happen. Fine. Then it's like, okay, I'm motivated by anger to get the degree, to go to the gym. Like, you're touching anger a lot in your life. Of course you're going to, and then again, you respond to things in a way that's angry with your words, you're in traffic, but you're cursing. So here we go. Like, you're creating all these habits. We could do the same thing with sadness, right? Same thing with pretty much every negative emotion. And I think positive emotions too, to a degree, can also kind of be, let's say, internally and externally contagious. We have to watch these habits though. Back to examining the self. Right? If you're generally optimistic, things will, I think, likely feel a little bit more manageable. right? Even optimistic, we could put in quotes, right? Because I think even that isn't the word I'm searching for right now. Right? If we, again, it's not about, as we had with anxiety already too, it's not about eradicating these things. There are some very interesting arguments. I just read a chapter, I may have mentioned this, about hard determinism. I'm not going to, you know, maybe I'll do a lecture on that. Because I don't want to give it like too much of a cursory, because it's a big idea. I don't want to give it like a superficial meaning behind it, right? But the degree to which we're influenced by our environment, our upbringing, let's say our natural dispositions, right, quote unquote, right? Because we can argue all this stuff, right? We may ask, like, to what degree are we responsible for our choices? It's a really philosophical question, right? Again, a lot of what we're doing here is sort of operating under the assumption that we have at least some degree of control over our choices, right? Our ways of thinking, feeling, and acting. But we can really challenge that. And I really want to construct a lecture on that that'll be more effective. I might not even be able to do it this summer, and I apologize, because I want to work with that idea more before I get into it. But I do think that at least raises that question, right? Yeah, Carmelo, for sure. If you are in pain, you will find fortitude. So because we've already spoken a little bit, and you know, Carmelo, you mentioned you're a coach, right? How do you get better, right? Even like, let's say, and I use certain analogies, like let me know if they're useless, like lifting weights, right? If you want to get stronger, you have to be uncomfortable, right? Like if you want to really push yourself to lift more weight, there's going to usually be some pain there, right? It's not like you're not going to be lifting more weight, smiling and giggling, right? It's like there's a sense that you're under stress, right? So I think we can see Epictetus sort of channeling that a little bit here, right? Through pain, we find strength. I think the weightlifting is actually a pretty good example of that. Thank you. It's a good analogy. That analogy works. Cool. Yeah, I think that actually, again, for me, I try to think about the mind, the body, and the soul as sort of in communication with each other, right? And I think spiritually too, right? We could say you don't really become more patient until you get tested, right? And that test will be uncomfortable. It'll be maybe painful in some way. I also think we could say this is aspirational. Wouldn't you want this, right? People who take pain and become stronger from it, they're gaining something good. Right, you don't want to be the person for the Stoics, especially who's in pain and just stays in pain, or who is weakened by their pains. So this is, again, it's asking us to see coping as a way of becoming stronger. You want to become less anxious. Again, a pathway to that, I think, is becoming more confident. Well, what is confidence, right? It's kind of a relationship between internal, external voices, our adoption of those voices, our assimilation of those voices. And then ultimately, confidence is like the virtue that's behind all other virtues, right? Because you need to believe in yourself to take action, right? I think to a large extent, that's accurate. So, you know, this is a quote from the show Kim's Convenience, which I've been watching. What was it? Confidence builds strength, and strength builds confidence. I think that's pretty cool, right? So, yeah, was that a good elaboration, Carmelo? Can I move on? So, Carmelo, if I'm going to go back to that, let me know. But I also think that my elaboration on book 10 from Nicomachean Ethics kind of actually connects to that quote nicely, right? So just going to highlight a couple points here. So this is Aristotle, you know, as I think I may have mentioned, giving advice to his son, right? So this is a great few ideas here, I think. Let me find my situation. Now, many events happen by chance, and events differing in importance, small pieces of good fortune or of its opposite, clearly do not weigh down the scales of life one way or the other. But a multitude of great events, if they turn out well, will make life happier. For not only are they themselves such as to add beauty to life, But the way a man deals with them may be noble and good. So good things happen, they're easier to deal with, obviously, right? While if they turn out ill or poorly, they crush and maim happiness, for they both bring pain with them and hinder many activities. So here he's sort of, in my opinion, grappling with fortune and misfortune from externals. Again, the external world exists, we have to engage with it. Yet, even in these negative events, nobility shines through when a person bears with resignation many great misfortunes, not through insensibility to pain, but through nobility and greatness of soul. So how do we cultivate greatness of soul? Philosophy. Not only through philosophy, right? But philosophy helps us with that, I think, a lot. So what does that mean? Well, we think maybe about the people we admire for a moment, right? They do this. People who go through hard times, right? Who go through suffering, and this is where I'm seeing the connections here, right? But instead of becoming bitter or resentful or angry or dishonest, they don't, not only do they not allow their morality, their personhood, their soul to be affected, right? If anything, they, once again, use that pain to increase those things. They, as we had with our meditation, right? They fight that suffering and they become, let's say, more noble people, right? So we should strive for that, right? And again, he's talking to his kids. So it's like, look, you're going to have difficulties in life. You don't have to, let's say, allow them to direct who you become. And again, this is a very arguable point, right? Very arguable point. I think we have to keep in mind that he is advising someone he loves, right? And maybe this is overly optimistic. That being said, I think for Aristotle, the idea of what we do habitually impacting us, who we become, is a very powerful point for him. Right? So we can respond, okay, in a way that cultivates nobility versus the opposite of that. And he says, if activities are, as we said, what gives life its character, no happy person can become miserable, for they will never do the acts that are hateful and mean. So he's connecting this idea of becoming to our actions. And I think that's something that some philosophers agree with, others disagree with. Just to give this some support, if this is of interest, right? Jean-Paul Sartre, the existentialist, who we can argue a number of points on his philosophy, right? It's, again, I'm not going to get into that necessarily right now, but he argues that basically we're responsible for our actions and our choices, and those are what shape us. And we are alone in that. We are fully responsible. So I think, again, there's a lot of points to counter that, some of which I mentioned earlier, that our upbringings are real, our environments are real, and these are things that Sartre doesn't seem to take account for in, let's say, his work, Existentialism as a Humanism, right? So maybe Sartre is too extreme in that regard, and we could sort of look at Aristotle to an extent, at least what we're seeing here, as, let's say, like a slightly more balanced version of that, right? Where we have some sense that we can guide our actions, right? The aim for our actions for Aristotle ultimately is happiness. For him, happiness is the only final and self-sufficient end of an act we take as a result of our own will. So even in that idea, he's acknowledging that we have a will. So maybe we could say Sartre's over here, Aristotle's like maybe here, and then on this side we have the hard determinist view where, you know, one even questions whether or not we have free will at all, right? And would say no. So just again, I like to present different perspectives so we can see what fits for us. That being said, I think Aristotle here is offering something that warrants consideration. The events of life do not have to turn us into things, for Aristotle, that we do not want to be. We have some degree of control over this. Okay. For the person who is truly good and wise, he says, we think, bears all the chances of life becomingly and always makes the best of circumstances. So that's the silver lining to Carmelo's point. That's the perspective, or the power of perspective. And we're adding to the perspective the power of action, right? For Aristotle, on the part of Nicomachean Ethics, right, we learn by doing. You want to be an honest person, learn how to tell the truth. You want to be an honest person when it's easier to lie, learn how to tell the truth when you're ignoring the fact that you can gain something from the lie. And again, by this I would say too, we have to make sure, because there can be a benevolent or a good lie for sure, right? But we have to make sure that in this case, we're not lying for reasons that aren't good, for reasons that aren't, let's say, just for our own gain and for reasons that are manipulative versus helpful, right? So it's training of the self. The self-writing we'll talk about today, that's another mode of training of the self. But of course, the actions we take in the world are also, for Aristotle especially, and also for Justin Renson, Sartre one more time, right? We act and then we become, if we're going in line with some of these thoughts that are, you know, being put up for consideration here. And again, I think there are some practical applications to this. Aristotle was a practical philosopher, right? He believed we practice philosophy, which is to say, let's, you know, for a moment, think of that as a primarily thinking endeavor. Well, for him, it's like, no, like we have to think so we can act better, because actions make us who we are and actions impact the world. Right? Jean-Paul Sartre in his speech famously said, right, there is no reality outside of action. So I think, you know, regardless of whether or not we have free will or whether we're the impetus or the initiators of that action, or whether or not we're the final legislator, as he believes we are, others would disagree with that, behind our action, right? Either way, we're taking action, right? And either way, we could say, you know, deal with Descartes for a little bit, I think, therefore I am, right? I act, therefore I become, is in addition to that. And I would hope that a lot of what we're doing here with our meditations, you know, we're examining our actions. Right, so whether we are the, let's say, the impetus or the final decider of our actions, we, inarguably right now, even being in this class, we're taking some kind of action. Right, so we can maybe work to heighten the consciousness around how we reflect on our actions, and all of a sudden, through that reflection and through new actions, we may be able to give our lives a sense of direction. And even if, for a moment, we believe that we cannot do that, and let's say everything, this is such a cool philosophy to me, I'm sorry if I'm ranting about this, but it's so interesting to me because I grapple with this a lot, right? Is everything already written, right? Are we predetermined? It's a beautiful question. It's a really beautiful, interesting question, right? And the larger question behind that might be, well, what are the implications of that? If life is a movie that I'm observing, am I responsible for enjoying it or not? Is that within my control? Right? If things are destined to happen, I'm destined to be a type of person. What does that really imply? That I have to accept this fate? Right? There's a really interesting question to me. And I'm going to leave this point after one more quick analogy. And I apologize if this is a bit of a rant, but I find myself drawn to these questions as we're talking today. The Stoics had an interesting idea that we as in all humans, right, are sort of like, in the example they gave was a dog with a leash tied to a cart, right? And the leash gives us enough room to walk around, right, to an extent, like a few feet here, a few feet there, we can sit and relax, but the cart's gonna move, right? So the cart is kind of like the universe, right? Maybe the cart is destiny, is fate. So if the cart moves, we could try to fight the cart and like hurt ourselves, or we can learn how to go with the cart and like, at times even use the cart to help us. And maybe sometimes we should fight against the cart, right? But ultimately it's this acknowledgement that we're not, for with that analogy at least, we're not entirely free. Again, Sartre would totally disagree with that. He literally says we are freedom. Right, so these are very interesting points, just to present a couple of things for our consideration, right? As Aristotle is encouraging us to take action, and he would even say in other parts of this reading, you know, those who act win and rightly win, not always, right? That's a naive point. That being said, though, I think it's safe to argue, or a good argument to make, that we need to take some kind of action in the world to make it a better place. We need to take some kind of action in our own lives to make ourselves, help ourselves thrive, right? Sorry if I'm ranting a little bit here, but I think these are very interesting conversations. I'll get back to more about the chapter now. I'm sorry. The same water that hardens the egg soft. Yeah, that's a cool quote, Carmelo. Very, very much in line with what we're saying here. Yeah, so Carmelo, I think for Aristotle, he's saying we do admire people who deal with adversity in a positive way. And that's the quote you asked about too. That's a person who in pain finds strength. When someone's going through a tough time and they're able to smile at it, I think we do admire them. And I bring up the idea of admiration too, because a lot of what we're talking about with the On Coping chapter, for example, I think in number 10, right? He's saying to talk to yourself as if you were talking to a good friend, like to advise yourself, and he even suggests talking to a friend, right? Who'd be willing to listen and kind of add to your points and maybe give you some constructive criticism in a loving way, right? So I think sometimes too, when we work to see ourselves, that works for us nicely. And other times it creates a greater sense of, let's say, well, I'm opaque. That'll happen. So we change the perspective, right? So, okay, so what would I tell a friend? If it's hard for me to talk to me right now, what would I tell a friend? If it's hard for me to hear myself right now, let me ask a friend maybe. Let me perhaps even turn to the bibliotherapy to hear what a philosopher has to say about this issue, right? So all different pathways to knowing ourselves. And again, we can grapple with the degree to which we can shape ourselves. But I think for the sake of our discussions today, especially, like, we should think that we, at least to some capacity, can do that. So let's take a quick break because it's already 10:20. Let's take a quick 10 minutes. Let's say 9 minutes. Let's come back at 10:30. And if we have no other questions on this chapter, we actually covered the majority of the readings quite nicely, I think. So we'll now go to the chapter on practices, okay? So let's take a quick 9 minutes here, and I'll see everybody back at 10:30. Thank you so far. This is really good.